This is the Land and Legacy Podcast, brought to you by Whitetail Properties Real Estate. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye. This is your weekly resource for habitat management, wildlife management, and recreational real estate. We hope you guys enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy Podcast. We are here in southern Missouri. I guess just me and special guest today, but we're going to be talking specifically about small property whitetail management. And this is more or less a success story or catching back up on what's prepping to be an awesome fall for this individual and client of Land Legacy. So he's not a new face to the podcast. He's been on before, but we talked a totally different topic than what we're going to cover today. And he's been really good at keeping me up to speed on all the things that have happened over the course of initial site visit. And I had a chance to go back here, maybe it was last year, and just kind of follow up after the timber management and just kind of, let's say, fast track some of the success and regeneration, getting ahead of what's happening after a timber harvest. So to introduce him, we've got Daniel Adams on the podcast out of Maryland. Daniel, how you doing?
Doing excellent. How are you?
I am doing so well. Chilling in a hammock actually right now at the house and just recording. We've gotten rain. It's not 100 degrees. It's only 90 and I'm in the shade and I'm like, you know what? Life is good.
Rain's new for you, right?
Yeah. Yes. He's like, well, this is the color green. I forgot what that looked like. But no, it's all good. How's your garden looking? And so for those who don't know, the last podcast that you were on, we talked like all about garden, family, kind of homesteading, because you're super big into that. So kind of give a quick recap of outside of wildlife, what are you growing and what is living on your farm right now?
Gosh, yeah, perfect. So, last time I was on, we talked about homesteading, which is my wheelhouse just my passion, really. And right now we have, we're going to do 8 pigs this year, like 15 turkeys, 60 meat birds. I have 40 egg layers, 7 sheep. Sheep are new this year. Price of feed has gone crazy up. So we're like, we need something that just eats grass and drinks water.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
That was kind of the hit a home run with them. And then the garden, I got a hoop house this year. So,
nice.
Grew my first super successful plantings of like cauliflower and broccoli and cabbage and things like that. I've done okay before, but it was a world of difference in the hoop house.
Sure.
Potatoes, sweet potatoes, winter squashes, pumpkins, melons, tomatoes like crazy. Did 2 plantings of corn. The second planting will be ready in a week or two. Just everything. Elderberries.
Nice.
I know you, Matt, and I always text about my I'll sell anything to anybody type thing.
Yes.
And so I posted on a foraging, and this ties everything together, really.
Right.
I posted on a foraging website or a Facebook group on Facebook about my overabundance of elderberries and that I'd be willing to have people come out and pick them. But the elderberries are $20 a pound.
Yep.
Man, I got people coming out and picking, and I'm using that money to pay people to help me improve my property. So I got cash for selling elderberries, which I really wanted anyway, and use that cash to pay a buddy to put 60 gallons of herbicide down the hose this past week. So
I love it, dude. You, for everyone listening, this is the most resourceful man out there, period, whatsoever. To tell you a quick story, so you had the timber harvest, and of course we knew that based on the tree species and regeneration rates and the success of reproduction, tulip poplar was going to come back. and come back probably with a good vengeance. And you literally went out and plucked and pulled, captured the root system of some of these seedlings of tulip poplar, and you sold like starts of tulip poplar, a foot, 2 foot tall seedlings at a farmer's market. I'm like, who does this besides Daniel Adams? But that is resourceful, and I like it.
Yeah, it was, I was sitting there pulling some, and I was just like, I got it. Somebody would want some of these, you know? And
there's some sucker out there.
Yeah. And one of the other fails this year, but attempts at it was the Legacy Blend was so successful that I decided I was going to harvest it as straw and then plant soybeans over that. Once it was baled, we got all the way to baling, and we could never get the baler to work. So that was kind of a fail, but I actually just planted another succession of fall things, and I went and I pulled, before we planted the beans, I pulled all the straw to the side as much as I could because we can't really burn here.
Yep.
And I recaptured that and used it as mulch in the garden just yesterday. So
you have a fall blend, and essentially, if the baler and all had worked, you had that straw sold to a local that would have covered the cost of seed and planting, correct?
Oh my goodness, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I probably would have gotten 200. It's like he was thinking like 100 bales per acre and, you know, $6 to $8 a bale.
That'll work.
So it's not, I can't do math. You don't do math in public. It's not polite, but, you know, I know the math is there. So
yeah, for sure. So, I just love, you love your, the way you, honestly, you take like that homestead mindset of, well, how can I use this product or can I create this into some sort of product and make this farm all kind of work seamlessly together from a wildlife standpoint, from raising animals to composting to, production out of the garden from produce. There's so much connection here that man, so many people generally just absolutely miss. And so you bring this nice, let's say, component back into like land management from an aspect of, we're talking all land management. We're talking trees. We're talking bees. We're talking pollinators. We're talking forest regeneration. We're talking food from turkeys and deer that can be put onto a plate to the produce out of the garden. A lot happens on your property. And let's tie it right back into what we want to talk about. And that's like maximizing the potential on small acreage. So paint the picture for everyone listening, you know, property size, property shape, its general location. And because, you know, again, guys, all of this is happening on a smaller parcel of property. So what does that look like?
Yeah, sure. So we officially own 23 acres, but we are split up by the power lines. Mm-hmm. And so if you encompass our entire property, we are 35 huntable acres or homestead acres. In Matt and I's plan, we have a homesteading block, which is close to the house. The rest is, for wildlife management. The property kind of like meanders, I think Matt calls it, and just kind of goes. It's rather skinny and long, and I think when you were here your first time, you said, this is the largest 30 acres I've ever been on.
It feels so much bigger than 30 acres.
And we're actually just under 1,000 yards tip to tip.
Yep.
And so, if that, again, that math makes it that I can't be wide anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So I have little blocks here and there, and you know, we laid out a couple of bedding thickets. I have all the way at the back is pretty like a riparian area that then transitions to those bedding thickets, which are north facing slopes. Then to kind of my upland area where we have the larger fall food plot and a little revival blend plot that we did as well. Once you reach kind of that area is kind of where it, the house is. And, we have a long strip of, what the Old Field Management, we call it. Mm-hmm. And then right along the Old Field Management is we have our garden and our homestead block. We rotate all our animals. And then on the very south end, we have another bedding thicket. We have a random 1.6 acres, perfectly square, no right of way, no driveway. It's just awkward, but that's a bedding thicket. And then on the other bottom left-hand corner, far south is backs up to a park and a school, and there's quite a bit of doe bedding back in there as well. And I've shot a nice, there's a revival blend down there as well, and I shot a nice doe out of that with muzzleloader once or 2 years ago, I think it was. But
yeah,
I mean that's 80 yards from our house, so it's tight, but it works. We try to make the deer feel comfortable. We have quite a few very distinct paths that were made. We had a very aggressive timber harvest, so Matt came before the timber harvest, and you've come post timber harvest for a visit.
Yep.
It's funny, I had some friends with me, and I said they saw it's my beekeeper, so they've always been here, and they see the land and stuff, and they're like, wow, you cut a lot of trees down. I said, I bet you one of the first thing Matt says is you gotta cut more trees. So we walked through, and so we've been doing a lot of TSI, a lot of invasive spray, and just keeping the trails open, and just kind of seeing a really, really great response. So
yeah, awesome. So, you know, that's a lot that happens in 35 acres, a lot of different, let's say, elements to the property. Even just, you know, we're still able to work in food plot locations. We're still able to work in destinations, some little kill plots, and then some more intensely timbered areas for bedding thickets. And then you have a lot of transition, a little bit of corridor throughout there. And so does the property hunt perfectly? Nah, probably not. Does it hunt good enough and attract enough deer to be successful? Yes, it does. But at some point, I think there's got to be consideration in the balance of, and you're trying to create a homestead. You're living on this property. There's other factors that influence, you know, everything. And it's not just a sole hunting property. And it's still awkwardly shaped, lots of long linear paths or stretches on the property that aren't very wide. But again, at the end of the day, we're making this thing work. And I want to kind of paint the picture for people of what's kind of transpired, because it's 35 acres, but you have hunting pressure around you. Like this is not just like, I would call you a suburban-ish type setting. I mean, there's a lot of, you have a lot of neighbors, right? And we all know there's still a lot of deer, and specifically people aren't aware of this, but maybe, but Maryland has got a huge deer population. I mean, overrun with deer. But we're still seeing quality deer come out of this area. So kind of talk to us about, let's say, some of the hunting pressure around you, and then the fact that we poured, let's say, a lot of emphasis into the cover, and even with a different property shape, smaller acreage, and hunting pressure around you, what you're seeing right now from the deer that are there, well, they were there last year too. So like you're getting deer through the seasons, and that's important. So I'll turn it over to you. Talk on that for a little bit.
And we had a deer named Daywalker, and he survived as well. So we have enough. We're in hopefully providing enough cover and things for the deer to get through the season, which has been proven by our cameras and stuff. But I mean, I'm between two fairly decent sized roads. I'm about 45 minutes out of DC, and my property pretty much runs north and south. And so to my west is a fairly large farm that has just corn, soybeans. And then to my east is the Chesapeake Bay. But it's before that is, I think what a lot of these bucks benefited from previously was there was a heavy timber operation there as well. But it's gotten to the point where it's all invasives, it's out of control, and basically what I don't want to have happen to my response, right?
That's right.
So I mean, I'm basically able to catch deer as they come from cover or are on my cover, and they're going to the crop fields or they're going to my destination food plots. And so I originally called Land Legacy to basically help me understand, because I was not able to really get a lot of deer to come up more or less up to my food plots, up to my areas where I felt more comfortable hunting, because they would just travel a valley that was far back. I couldn't bow hunt it, just the thermals and all that kind of just a lay of land is not perfect, yeah, like you said.
It's a really unhuntable location with that wind swirl. Man, it was going to be tough.
Yeah, but I'd have a camera down there, and you'd be like, that's where they are. And you go down there, it's like, that's not where I need to be. You
know? Yeah.
So it was very limited to limited to gun season, and like you said, we have neighbors, and so the farmers get talking, and if you see one deer, they think all the deer are eating their soybeans, so they're yelling at the homeowners that they're leasing the property from to kill all the deer and that kind of stuff. So there's people that are lined up on the side of soybean fields and things like that. Just trying to reduce the deer numbers, and I think the state's trying to do the same.
Right.
With the bag limits and stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure, and so the desire was to improve the property so that I could hold some deer. I know that I can't hold all the deer that I want, or the deer that I get on camera, or the deer that are going to come through for me to shoot, the bucks that will be there during the rut or things like that. And so I had to basically slow them down as they walk through my property. And the desire was, instead of them going across my property at my width of 60 yards, they get to my property and they go left or right, and mm-hmm. they come and they spend three times the amount of time and distance on my property, because it's secure. I'm telling them where to go with my paths. They're able to eat native stuff or woody browse or just regen. And their end goal is my revival blend or my legacy blend at the top. And hey, that's where I'll be. I'll see you there, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's the ever changing goal and manipulation of the property, is to focus it so that, again, they just slow down when they come here, and I'm able to protect them with my neighbors. And really, I do have a lot of neighbors that hunt, but I've been able to speak with them and say, look, this was the deer 3 years ago. This was the deer 2 years ago. And I'm the only one right now running cameras, and look at him now. I was like, mm-hmm. That's why we don't shoot the younger deer. And they're just like blown. They're just blown away.
Sure.
And so it's a just sharing, you know, on 30 acres, you probably want to hide your phone and say, I don't have any deer here, you know, but if you expose yourself and you say, this is what I'm seeing, and tangibly show them how a deer grows, or how we're able to hold them closer or not bust them out in the first week of gun season, you know, those are tangible things that you can prove with your cameras, with deer sightings and things like that, that, you know, really go a long way to, you know, creating a little block of really good stuff.
So. Yeah. And I think that's the most important thing. We're not on the podcast here to say that, you know, you're raising five different 4.5-year-olds that you have on camera on 35 acres or we're not suggesting that, but what we are saying that there is an absolute influence with the habitat, saying, suggesting, recommending, influencing, whatever you want to call it, how deer can maneuver through a property. They spend more daylight activity on you and time, well, then you have more influence of what gets shot, what doesn't get shot, but still collectively, you know that they're going to walk off the property. They take two mm-hmm. steps in some areas and they're on and off the property just because of shape and layout, right? So you've gone the extra step, made yourself vulnerable in talking to your neighbors and saying, hey, I want more out of this. We can get more out of this lemon, but we gotta work together here. And you're seeing the benefit of not only managing a habitat aggressively, right? So you were completely forested. Now you're definitely, you could see, okay, there's a timber harvest here. You're managing the understory and what comes back and spraying aggressively against invasive species. But the amount of forage production, the amount of cover production now on your property, you're seeing selection from these deer, does, bucks, older, more mature bucks as well on your property. This is, it's important to say that, again, they're using other people's property too. However, this is not like, it's not a random occurrence that this deer walk by. Like, these are home bodies. They're on you often. So you have, again, influence and significance. You're offering significant habitat and benefit to them because they're selecting you often. It's, again, it's not a, well, I got him once 3 weeks ago and then he's gone. Oh, well, then he popped up during gun season. Nah, these are regular occurrences. I think I texted you earlier in the week. I was like, hey, man, let's do a podcast because there's a lot of deer. So, okay, I've got another trail camera out that's probably got some better resolution images that we could use. And once I get some of those, I'll send them over. 3 days later, boom, boom, boom. Here's seven pictures of like big rack bucks. Again, like it's that type of frequency that we're talking about. And I think that's important to really kind of depict of like what we're terming as or classifying as, hey, this is successful. This is working. This is having the impact that we want. And it's, again, just as a reminder, some odd shaped 30 acres, but my gosh, it works. Like native habitat and quality habitat has influence, even in high pressured areas.
And I think I wouldn't want a perfect square of 30 acres. Like, I think this is better, you know, in my biased opinion, you know, it's like I can stretch 1,000 yards and I can hit different areas and things like that. And it's funny because I texted you last year when the biggest buck in the neighborhood got shot and was almost a mile away. But that buck every night came, and this is my first spring green up since the timber harvest. So they got off the property like in August, September, July, August sometime. So there wasn't much of a response in the fall. So there's bucks that we have named and things like that, but the trails weren't all in, like it didn't have all this regen yet. But that buck would always come to my revival blend 80 yards from my house, the biggest buck in the neighborhood. And I could text my neighbor who hunted that spot down a mile away at the marina. I could text him and say, he was here at this time, he was here at that time. And we are able to coordinate, and he was able to shoot that buck 0.9 miles from my house. And I went down there and opened up that belly, and it was full of revival clover and all that jazz. I was just like, shazam, you know?
Yeah.
And you even texted me last year. You said instead of going 0.9 miles last year, he's going to only have to go 90 yards this year because of the security that's going to be here, the paths that are going to be here, and things like that. And we've really seen that change of more frequency and not middle of the night. We've been seeing, 9:30, 10 o'clock, daylight stuff. That one in the bottom in daylight that I showed you is a phenomenal buck. So yeah, it's just it's definitely trending and continuing to be in the right direction, which is really fun to watch.
Absolutely, and that's the cool thing about watching what happens after a timber harvest, an aggressive timber harvest, because you go through those stages of let's say revegetation, right? Because before it was high deer density, so very little understory except for the bottom. There was some spice bush and such, and then everything else was primarily non-native invasive that was growing that deer just weren't consuming. So you went from an area that didn't have a ton of understory to now there's no understory the next season because of the timing of the logging, the lack of regeneration, then you went into a dormant season. So now as things are developing much more, you're able to capitalize. And this is the second growing season, correct, after the timber harvest? Is that right?
This will be the first.
This will be the first full one. Okay. This is the first full one. Even what you see from this year going into next and beyond. Like you're every year you're gaining cover and density of that cover, composition of that cover, from herbaceous to bramble to some more woody sprout, like the amount of sunlight that's on that site, the continual removal of the invasive species. You're making more room, and so it's just going to be really neat to see over the course of the next 3 years this further develop of that shrinking of home range, the consistency of activity. But even with year one full growing season through here, you've seen an adjustment, a shift. And so how many bucks was it that you sent over to me in a text that were, you know, substantial deer? And then out of that, what's some of the age classes that are represented there?
Yeah, so I sent you five that are like 4.5+, and then two that are really nice, like 3.5-year-olds. And then I figured you get enough pictures, so I didn't include all the younger ones. But
right.
There's quite a mix for sure. And
so seven bucks that are 3.5 and older. Only two of those are three. The rest are 4.5+. Right.
Right.
And I mean, what's that? The day walker buck. I mean, he was a great deer last year. What do you think he might score out this year?
Oh, I have no idea. He blew up for sure. And I have,
yeah, he's not a slouch.
I probably have a couple blurred pictures of him, and I don't know. You're more of the expert on that for sure. But I mean, he's big for sure.
He's big enough.
Yeah, exactly. I think that buck in daylight in the bottom that I sent you might be bigger.
He might be bigger. Yeah.
That big eight.
Yeah, he's really good. What was the big deer in the neighborhood last year that your buddy shot? Was that ever scored?
I don't believe it was. He took it to taxidermist and was kind of dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll text him after this and I'll let you know for sure. So.
Yeah, but again, this is just further evidence of. I feel like a lot of people, a lot of landowners, give themselves. Or try to just use the excuse of, well, I'm a small landowner. I don't have much influence. I can guarantee you, if you don't do anything, you won't have any influence. You'll just be stagnant and still and not proceed, right? But man, go ahead.
Let's just say my buddy from Southern Iowa, Drew, saw those pictures and he got worked up. So.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he's unfamiliar to large deer, and he was like, "Now those are some nice deer." I said, "Well, let's go hunt them," you know.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's significant the impact that you can have on a neighborhood. You're not limited by your property shape. You're not limited by your property size. You're limited by your vision to see it and your ability to implement. And that's one thing I really appreciate about you. Is that you weren't scared to take some big swings, in the amount of trees that were being harvested, and truthfully that was done before I didn't recommend the harvest. You had that timber sold before I got there. Basically, it was like you just need to know what we're doing afterwards, like what are the next steps, because again that just goes to show that you're not scared to make changes that are necessary, right? And I think that's one of the biggest limiting factors. Again, not property size, not property shape. It's the ability to see and have vision that things can be better, and let's do X. Let's commit to the big things to get there. And you're one of those who is willing to do that. So, what would you say to someone who is apprehensive of change, especially on a place too that they live on. So like you're seeing this change. Like it's not like, sure, oh, I just visit it during the week, the weekends, right? Like, no, you live here too. So kind of talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, so I lived, well, obviously I live here, but I lived through the logging operation. The majority of the trees came 8 yards from my front door.
Yep.
All the 18-wheelers came right in front, right? So that's an invasive procedure, you know?
Yes.
And so, but we've done it in at our property up in New York, not to the extreme, but I just knew I had to change. I knew it's not what I wanted, and I knew that there was a process to get there. And so I just went with it. And so Matt was called after we had a contract, but you were helpful, just education and the passion and the desire to do things post-harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And you really helped guide a lot of their trails and things like that, trail systems. And so there really was a added piece from you, even though we already had that contract. So really, you just gotta go for it. And I think it loops back to, like, in your literature that you sent me when after your consultant consultation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was Chad and you last week were talking about, it was basically like, don't, like, if I had 100 acres, I would not do it the same way I would do it with 35, because I'm, number one focus is obviously family and things of that sort, and then the homesteading, and then hunting. So
yes,
I know my priorities, and I know how much time I have to give.
Yep.
I can handle a full-on hardcore 35 acres, but I would not do it at 160 or whatever. So
mm-hmm.
I know my limitations in terms of that. But
yep,
to that point, if you have a larger property, in your literature you said work in units, spread out diversity, right? So if I go and I say I can attack this area or I can attack this area, it will give you diversity as you go, and you won't get discouraged as you go, because you're making progress. You're fixing something that is currently broken while not getting overwhelmed by the whole process. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The process of logging is overwhelming, and it is a big bandit to pull off, but you're not doing that work necessarily.
That's right.
And as long as they're working within your guideline, I mean, you just got to do it. You got to get that sunlight to the ground. You got to promote cover and native responses, and then hit those invasives hard when they come back. I mean, I had my loading dock for all my logs was straight multiflora rows, and
that's truth.
None of them came back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was expecting something, but nothing came back. That was, hey, we're going to put our loading dock here. I want this whole area cleared. This multiflora rose is terrible. And I haven't had to spray once.
Wow. Wow.
And so my main tackle right now is the Japanese silk grass is in the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
but,
that's the other, I guess, aspect of it too, that I want you to speak on is, I can't remember the exact number of, invasive species that were identified on your place, but I want to say it was like 7 or 8 different invasive species, from, you know, mile
yeah.
a minute to Japanese honeysuckle, autumn olive, Japanese
yeah.
stilt grass, multiflora
yeah.
rose, probably some bush honeysuckle, oriental bittersweet, like a ton of different ones, right? So
what's the shrub in front of the house that people, the Japanese boxwood or whatever, the one people put in front of their windows so people don't
yep.
rob it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Barberry.
Barberry. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Let's just say that you went back on the podcast the next week with Adam and you were talking about my property and he said, goodness, just light the whole thing on fire. Come on, man.
Well, but honestly, you made the decision to log, and I think one of the biggest conversations that we are having is, since we're logging, and that would have been recommended, obviously, anyhow, there's going to be an increase in the amount of sunlight, and these species are going to want to come back aggressively. And you accepted that and have been very diligent in the response of your time and energy in addressing those invasive species, and have gotten a really good handle on, even though you've increased the amount of sunlight in there, you've been diligent to remove the bad and promote the good. And that, like, follow-up management, and this is a podcast coming. Jen and I were talking about it yesterday, but and Kyle, but the follow-up management is such a missing point in farms, and that separates you from your neighbors that you can look across the property line and say, wow, they had a timber harvest, and my gosh, look at that response. And that was an understory of, you know, all they did was accept the check from the logger and walk away. And we knew that, hey, that's an example of what we don't want to do, because that's going to be the response. We can improve it. And you're doing that, and you're diligent, and you're moving in units, and you're tackling things, and you're making progress. And it just is important for people to know that, like, you might don't complain about, you know, a 30 acre unit of timber that's been logged, and you only have one of those species to address. There's other people out there. Like, let's have some perspective of, there's other people out there fighting harder than you, and so there's no excuse, essentially, to not get after it, because here's the results that could happen. Even in a suburban area with a lot of deer a lot of hunting pressure, you can have five bucks that are 4.5 and older cruising through your place. That is doable.
And I thankfully I had the contract, and it's a 2-year contract, and I think you came a couple of months to maybe a full year in the middle of that contract, and they waited till the end of their contract. So I really had I had quite some time, maybe about a year, a little less than a year, to that was a big light bulb for me when you came the first time, was invasive. So I to what I like to call my own credit of getting after what you told us to do, was we knocked back quite a bit of invasives before the timber harvest as well.
Yes, you did.
And so in my main hunting area, it's pretty much just the Japanese silkgrass in the valley in the bottom where they naturally want to cross anyway. And my bedding thickets are not just exploding with junk. It's exploding with good stuff. And, you know, outside of, you know, tulip poplar and sweet gum regen that I'm gonna deal with, but it's not full of the multiflora rose and the autumn olive and trash like that. It's getting the asters, it's getting the pokeweed, it's getting the blackberries. There's some goldenrod in random places. The stump sprouts are everywhere. The, like you said, the spice bush, all that kind of stuff is responding in those areas because we hit those invasives before that harvest.
Yeah, so. You anticipated, right, what was going to happen, identified that this is a potential issue down the road.
I trusted you. Well, I'm not sure I anticipated it until you came.
Well, regardless, the most important thing is you did that. Like, you spent the time to do it. You listened and said, okay, yeah, I can see where that's going to be an issue. And most importantly, because that's the thing I hope people understand, and that we try and stress on the podcast is, we could talk all day long about this stuff, and we can talk till we're blue in the face, but that doesn't change what's happening on the landscape. There has to be action. There has to be people out there working hard and doing this stuff to see the results like you have. And so, I could make that recommendation to you, but it doesn't mean anything until it's actually done. And you did the right steps, man. So definitely kudos to you. And is there any other points that you want to make about this? Because I'm going to put pressure on you, but I don't mean to. This is how confident I am in you. But I feel like there's probably going to be a follow-up podcast, hopefully mid to late September, when you're holding a harvest picture of one of these deer. That'd be just sweet success, man.
Yeah, no, for sure. I know you know this, but I texted Matt probably shortly after you were pretty blown away at the pictures that I was sending you. And I was like, if I FaceTime you mid-September, it's not a butt dial.
I will answer. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else that you want to tell everyone listening?
Yeah, I would just like loop back to kind of my idea, right? So like my of trying to just get stuff done with limited time and resources and stuff. It's like go, taking care of animals, doing the homesteading stuff, working on the garden. But my little brain went off and said, I could sell some elderberries, make some money, and pay someone to come and spray some invasives that I know are there, but I just don't have time to get to.
Yep.
And I still came out on top by selling elderberries. And so just the idea of, it's not just you that has to get it done, but you have to have the tools and the desire to go after it. And that my buddy that worked for 5 hours spraying invasives made a tremendous impact on my property. Mm-hmm. And it's just doing those little things that, you know, if it comes down to hiring somebody, or if it comes down to just taking a little bit of time yourself to do it, but just doing, consistently doing things to improve it and not biting off more than you can chew, is you'll just really see a change. And it's just really cool to watch. So
yeah.
I do it for the kids, and I do it for the experience of being outdoors. And my daughter wants me to build her a tree fort so we can go hunt deer, and she's turning 5 on Monday. So it's
awesome.
You know, it's just fun to, that's the whole point of it. You know, if I never shoot a massive buck, it's just the joy that it brings everybody. So that's what my 35 acres does, and just living the dream, you know.
That's it, man. I love it. And I love what you said there, was consistently doing something. You're like, yep, staying consistent. You know, you should have those clear, defined goals, and that's what I appreciate about you too, is here's where everything ranks, but I'm going to find the time to address all these things and just do it right and be consistent with it. This is what I want to experience. I want the 35 acres to bless our family in this way, and so here's how I'm going to achieve that. And certainly seems to be working. I love following up with you. I love the updates, but then also, you know, people can see this stuff and your farming success on Instagram. What, I'm going to give you a shout out. What's the name of the account?
Up in Adams Farm.
There you
know,
go.
Like a play on, you know, I'm up in Adam, but also looking to Jesus, you know.
That's it.
That's what we're about.
I love it. Well, man, appreciate your time. Appreciate you coming on the podcast, and best of luck early on this season. I'm excited to follow along. I'll be waiting for that butt dial.
I'm gonna do my best. I'll find time.
All right, sounds good, sir. We'll catch up with you later on.
Thanks.
All right, guys, there you have it. That was Dan Adams on the podcast this week, talking about 35 acres in Maryland and the success that can be had on small properties, irregular shapes. That's not really an excuse anymore. Quality habitat can trump that. So appreciate his time, but we appreciate you guys listening as well. And we'll catch you here next week.